I want to welcome you all here. I really want to welcome the newcomers. I can't imagine anything I would rather be doing today than what we're about to do. Not only am I get to participate in something that I've fallen in love with called Alcoholics Anonymous, but I get to do it with two guys that are, I tell you something, if you gave me 1,000 people to pick with, from to do a workshop with, I'd pick these two guys. I have a tremendous respect for them. I know them both personally. I've done step work with Clint. I've known Keith for a lot of years. And there's a lot of people that can talk real well in Alcoholics Anonymous, but the people that always I gravitate to, that I aspire to be with and be like, are the people that actually do it, that go and both these guys get in the trenches. They work with newcomers. They try to live these principles. And it's really an honor and a privilege for me to be here today with them, two of my personal heroes. I'm going to talk a little bit about unity, personal unity, group unity, a little bit about the 12 traditions, and then we're going to have probably 5 to 10 minutes of questions from the floor, a short break, and then Clint's going to talk about recovery and his experience with that and sponsorship and how we pass these things, the legacies on to the people we sponsor, followed by 5 to 10 minutes of questions from the floor and a short break. And then Keith is going to talk about the third legacy, service, and his personal experience with that and how he ties it in with his sponsorship. Unity. Why does a guy like me drink? I think in some obscure spiritual sense, I drank for unity. I drank because alcohol in the early days of my drinking did something for me that I hungered and needed to have done. It connected me to the people around me. And if you're an alcoholic with the spiritual malady of alcoholism like I have it, you have had the experiences that I have had of being at a junior high school dance, plastered against the wall, you can't talk to anybody, not fitting, having that pint of whiskey, and you can dance, and you can talk to people, you can come out and play, you get a sense of connectedness to the people around you. It gave me a thing of unity. And the dilemma that I faced in my alcoholism as the disease progressed, my ability to obtain unity and external, to become a part of this world through alcohol, diminished. Until at the very end, no matter what I drank, I was just as lonely and depressed and apart from drunk as I was when I was sober. And I was in a trap I couldn't spring. I needed somehow to obtain unity, and yet I had a seeming inability, and everything in my basic nature and character worked against that. When I started coming to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1971, one of the greatest obstacles to my own recovery is that you take alcohol away from me and I don't like people. And AA has a lot of people in it. Right? And I wanted to kind of come to AA, find out some kind of, you have some kind of eureka epiphany experience, and then get away from you and go out and do my thing. I didn't want to need you. I didn't want to need Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't want to need anything. And for 7 years, from 71 to 78, I never got a sense of unity here because I never took the actions that I'm sure Clint and Keith are going to touch on that eventually made me a part of here. And as a result, I know what it's like to sit in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous in the middle of rooms where people obviously love me, but I feel alone and apart from. I know what it's like to sit in the middle of AA and feel like I'm dying in here. And I can't seem to connect with other people the way they obviously connect with each other. I didn't want to need you. I'll tell you a little story that had happened to me after about five and a half years of relapsing. And by this time I've entered into a phase of alcoholism that is bleak. It's the phase of alcoholism where I'm just full of self-pity when I'm drunk. I'm depressed. I come to facing consequences of things I did that I can't remember. I come to sometimes because emotionally it's not fun anymore. It's so painful, even when I'm drunk, that I come to sometimes with broken hands because in rages and frustration with what's happening to me, I punch brick walls and stuff and don't even remember it, or put my hand through windows because I hate what has happened to me. And I desperately wish for the old days, and I can't get the old days back. And yet, I get sober. I'm continually forced into states of abstinence by running out of money and getting arrested and all the things that happen to people like me that make me get sober. And sobriety is just as bleak, except that there's no oblivion. There's no oblivion in sobriety. I was stuck, and I was in a halfway house in Pennsylvania with a guy, and he was my run-in partner. I used to like to partner up with people when I would have to go to AA. If you're going to judge AA, you got to have a friend that can judge you, so you judge properly, right? And we would go to meetings together. We'd sit in back of the room and whisper and talk through the whole meeting. And by the end of the meeting, we've pretty much figured out how screwed up all you people are. I mean, it's a great thing we're going to do. And we got on marijuana maintenance together, because this is Alcoholics Anonymous, right? It's not marijuana. And I got on that because I need something to take the edge off of this abstinence thing that is just awful. It's awful. And as a result of the marijuana maintenance, the obsession with alcohol returned, and I drank again. Because I that's what guys like me do with the spiritual malady of alcoholism. If I leave it untreated, my heart aches until I eventually have to satisfy it. And I went back to alcohol, and I got thrown out of the halfway house, and I'm living in the park. I'm living a homeless guy, and I've been out on a run for a while, and I'm dirty, and I haven't bathed, and I come up to the halfway house to beg nickels and dimes and quarters from the guys as they come out to do their laundry and go to work. And the guy that was my running partner comes out and he sees me. And he felt sorry for me and gave me a couple bucks. And he gave me that look that people like us were the only ones on earth that ever know that look. You know, that look. It cuts you down to the core of who you are. The look we get from our parents and we get from bosses and lovers and friends. It's that pity. I can't stand to be pitied. And oddly enough, him seeing me like that got him off the marijuana maintenance, got him a sponsor, and he started getting into Alcoholics Anonymous. Months later, I'm in another institution, and here he comes, and now he's with them. You know who them are? Oh, man. He's with them. He's with the people that are enthusiastic to see people like me when I'm down and out. And I'm watching this guy come into the place I'm in, and he's driving his own car. He's got two guys with him that are newer than him. He's got the light. He's got the thing, you know. He's got the thing in his eyes. And he's engaged to be married, and he's got a good job, and he's got it all. There's a line in our book. It says that the first thing we ever realize is that we see that it had worked in others, and we'd come to believe in the hopelessness and futility of our life as we'd been living it. You see, I could look at you and discount you because you're different from me. My case is different. But I couldn't do that with this guy. This guy and me, I knew he was like me. He was the first person in Alcoholics Anonymous that I actually knew was not one of them. He was a guy like me. And AA, I could see the change in him. And I came off that last run, and I was broken of spirit. And I wanted to be a part of you. I wanted to have a seat here. I wanted to get what that guy got. And I started to have some hope that it would be for me. I started to take the actions that would eventually unify me and make me a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. I bought a principle that it talks about in the first tradition, that my personal recovery depends upon AA unity. It depends upon me being connected to you, not apart from, not better than, not less than, but I have to join the ranks of Alcoholics Anonymous in order to survive this disease. And I didn't want to do that. I'll be your leader. Or I'll sit on the guide, I'll sit on the sidelines and judge you properly, but I don't want to be just another drunk, right? And in the 12th tradition, it talks about something that it took me probably 18 years here to understand what they really meant by it, and its significance in my life, when it talks about placing principles before personalities. I thought that what they were talking about is that I had to work the 12 steps and get those principles in my life so I could tolerate your screwed up personalities, right? And I got to tell you, there's only one personality I have to work those principles against, and it's me. I am the guy, I am the seat of all my judgment and separation. It all starts right in here. And I'll tell you, the reason that I work the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous and I sponsor guys and I have a sponsor and I try to do everything. At first, in AA, I thought that I would have to become a part of this fellowship in order to stay here long enough to eventually work the steps so that I could be okay. And then after a few years, I thought my view of AA had changed a little bit, where I thought I had to become part of you long enough to work the steps so I could help other drunks. And I'll tell you what I think today. I think that I have to come here long enough to find out how to put those steps into my life so that I can go out and help other alcoholics. And the combination of the principles before my personality and helping you is what secures my seat in AA, because I've watched people who were very, very spiritual edge themselves right out of here. And I need you. I need to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I work the principles of AA against my personality, because I'll tell you the basic thing about me. When you're an egomaniac with an inferiority complex like me, it's not so much that I feel like a piece of whale crap. I'm a very special piece of whale crap. A piece of whale crap that is painfully aware of what's wrong with everyone else. My basic problem is that I have a, because of the insecurity part, I have an ego that wants to play God. And I didn't know that. I used to go to my sponsor in early recovery, my first couple years, and I'd have lists of everybody in AA that's out of line. You know, she's just looking for a husband. He doesn't put any money in the basket. He lies in the meetings. He sounds like a Hallmark card in a recovery bookstore. On and on. You know, just they're not. He's not even an alcoholic. And I go to my sponsor with these, and he'd say the same thing to me over and over again. He says, "You got to quit playing God." I'm not playing God. I'm reporting accurate information here. I'm not playing God. What are you talking about? But I was playing God. I had created a state of separation between me and the people in AA through my judgment. Through my judgment. And when I was finally, between 4 and 5 years, able to go back and do the fourth step, as it's outlined in the big book, I discovered something that I never would have imagined. When I looked at the exact nature of my wrongs, it was more than the guy I stabbed and the things I robbed. The real exact nature of my wrongs is I've been so wrong in my judgments of people, of the things that I was so, the fears that I believed so adamantly that I never did anything over here because I knew I would fail. Right? I believed the fear more than I believed reality. and how I drove myself to be delusional in my sex relations, and I would superimpose expectations on other people, hoping that they would meet them so I will be better, and all how wrong I had been about everybody and everything in my life in this quest to play God, in this overcompensation for my own inadequacy and my own fear and that comes as a result of my own self-involvement. I'm always an overcompensator. You know, I think that's one of the major differences between me and people who don't have this disease. I'm the kind of guy that would, before a fishing trip, would hunt earthworms with sonar and bazookas. You know, it's like I overkill everything. I overmanage everything. I overcontrol everything because I'm so not enough. And that's the personality that I brought to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's the personality that the principles of AA had to work on so I could be a part of here. I'll tell you a little story that talks about, I think it has to do with unity. There's a branch of Hinduism. It's called Maya. And Maya means the great illusion. And they have a story of creation that I think is very touching and very significant to me. And the story, their story of creation is very different from the Judeo-Christian story of creation. In their story of creation, they envision God, who's just existed forever, all by himself, nothing else, just God. And after eons and eons of timelessness, God got bored with just hanging out with him. So he decided to play a little game. And the game was he was going to fragment himself into an infinite number of pieces, give them all amnesia, and the game was, let's see which pieces realize they're God and they're part of the whole first. Einstein said something that I think is very, very relevant. He said, the great illusion of mankind is that there's more than one of us here. There's more than one of us here. My ego is what creates the separation. In the book, in the part on step three, Bill talks about different examples of, he compares us to different examples in society. He talks about the retired businessman lolling in the Florida sunshine, complaining of the sad state of the nation. The politicians who are reformers who were sure all would be utopia if the rest of the world would only behave. He gives four or five examples like that, and all of those examples have one thing in common, that the people he's talking about sit in a state of separation through judgment from the rest, from the other pieces of them. Right, and that we are all the same. And if nothing has brought me more clearly, brought that home more clearly, it's been the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, where I started to obtain my sense of unity, especially when I went through my resentment list and I looked and I did, this was our course. And the book says you must realize how the people who had harmed you were perhaps like you. And when I could see myself in them and put myself in their shoes and say to myself and really know it and have a sense of it, that if I was afraid like that, if I was in that guy's spot, if I'd been raised like that, if I was drunk like that, if I was all of what he was going on in him was going on in me, that I would have reacted exactly the same as he did. And when I could see that, then some of the separation between me and the people I've resented started to dissolve away. And I was able to come back and look at where I'd made decisions based on self that fed the separation, and where was I selfish? Where was I dishonest? Where was I at fault? How did I create the separation between me and those people? And Alcoholics Anonymous is a program that's designed to create unity in me. And also there's an important aspect of unity in the groups. I think one of the dangers in AA is that if we allow too much stuff to come into AA that is outside the principles of this book in our recovery program, the danger is is that one day you'll go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous and not everybody's going to be on the same page anymore. As a matter of fact, you won't know what page is what. And the thing that binds us and unifies us as a fellowship is we have a common problem and a common solution that we, the book says, that we can unanimously agree on. You know what has happened in Alcoholics Anonymous over the last 20 or 25 years? As, unfortunately, as a result of our success and notoriety, is that now we're besieged on one side by religion and on the other side by therapy. They all want a piece of our action. They all want to line themselves up with our success. There are churches around the country that on their marquees now advertise 12-step workshops. The problem is if you ever go to those, they're not what we have. What they do is they take their particular dogmatic agenda and disguise it as our 12 steps. They're treatment centers that do the same thing with their therapeutic modality. And they alter it to fit it into the format of our 12 steps and then call that the 12 steps. And it's not. And what is happening is some of that is bleeding into AA. It's bleeding in here. And my great fear is that we will get so far away from this that in 10 years a guy will come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, be dying of alcoholism, and ask for help. And how do you do the steps? And he'll be showed 47,000 different ways to do them. And I think it is my job as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous to carry this message. Why? Because I'm convinced that it's the only message. I don't know. I really don't. Am I convinced it's the only way to heal spiritually? I don't know. But it's something that has worked for enough of us that we can unanimously agree on it. And it is the unifying force in Alcoholics Anonymous is that we have a common solution. And as a result of that, I sometimes find myself, I've become, in some groups in AA, I'm the pain in the ass guy, right? And it's hard to do that without creating a state of separation. And what I have to do is do it so if they want to be separate from me, it's okay, but I just can love them anyway. I was at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous about a month ago that frightened me. And I'm not easily scared in AA, but this meeting frightened me. It was at one of the clubs in Las Vegas, and there was probably 30 people there. There was three newcomers, brand new, within less than 30 days. The chairman of the meeting starts the meeting off. He's 15 and a half years sober, and he said he wanted to talk about the most important thing he's done in the 15 and a half years that he's been here. And he went on to tell us that 3 months or 2 months or whatever the period of time was prior, he got on these meds, and it's wonderful. And he no longer gets pissed at his wife, and he no longer gets pissed in traffic, and he's better with his boss. And he said, you know, and I was thinking about getting a sponsor, but this is really a lot better. Now, that was not the frightening thing. That I can say, well, that happens. What was frightening is as they went around the room, with no exaggeration, probably two-thirds of the room chimed right in and talked about the meds they were on and how wonderful their life was. And there's I'm sitting there and I'm imagining, I'm putting myself in the place of the newcomer. Okay, here we got getting a sponsor and being told what to do. Finding a relationship with God who you secretly suspect has been out to get you. Writing an inventory which feels like punishment. Making amends, giving away your money and your exposure of pride. And then spending the rest of your life, your precious time helping others. Or take a pill. And don't get me wrong. I am not one who I'm not a doctor. I don't I'm not an advocate that if there are people in Alcoholics Anonymous that, as there are, that legitimately need medication, that's fine. I don't have an opinion about that. I have an opinion about Alcoholics Anonymous being a format for anything other than Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's what frightens me here. I would feel the same way if some guy got up in an AA meeting and talked for 45 minutes about how Amway changed his life. You know, right? Our unity depends upon our common deal here. And the traditions. I am a member. My home group, we've been getting more and more into the long form of the traditions. And I think, and this is my feeling, that we took a hit as a fellowship when we adopted the short form. And I believe that because if you look at the different, if you sit down with the long form and the short form side by side and you look at them, there's some great differences. And I understand how we ended up with the short form. I understand Bill Wilson's frustration at trying to even get a group to read them. They don't want to read them. They're long. I mean, they cut into us talking about our favorite subject, me, right? And groups wouldn't read them. And it got so bad that Bill, who's the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, was getting asked to speak. And before they would let him come and speak, they would make him promise that he wouldn't talk about the traditions. And so members, as my friend Bob Pearson had told me, and another guy, and I was able to figure out as best I could in tracing the history of the events of the transition, that the pressure was on Bill to get these adopted, and he reluctantly conceded to an abbreviated version that I have never been able to find out who wrote the abbreviated version. I was told that it was the input of several different people. Bob Pearson seems to feel that it was some of the members of the newly formed Grapevine staff or people at GSO, along with some input from some other people. But whoever it was, even if Bill wrote them himself, we took a big hit. And I want to talk a little bit about some of the traditions that we took a hit and how it affects our unity. Bill one time said that if AA was ever to be destroyed, it would be from within. In the third tradition in the long form, as it was originally written, it had a membership requirement. And this, if you go back into AA history, this ties in with how 12-step work was done in the early days. It says membership should include all who suffer from alcoholism. I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous today because I suffer from alcoholism. I have a spiritual malady that needs a lot of tweaking and attention. Or else I get very weird. The problem is that when I get spiritually sick, I don't think I'm spiritually sick. When I get spiritually sick, it looks like it's you. It looks like it's you. And I'm capable. I could judge my way right out of here. Right out of here. But I'm an everyday member of Alcoholics Anonymous, not because of the requirement of the third tradition in the short form, a desire not to drink. To be honest with you, I haven't consciously thought about not drinking in a long time. If my membership in AA was based on a desire not to drink, I think I would have gotten that pretty early in sobriety and would have been able to leave here. But what I've never been able to do is get free of from my suffering of alcoholism. My natural inclination and propensity to be self-involved, to be judgmental, to get depressed when I'm playing God and it doesn't go my way. I suffer from all of that spiritual sickness that happens in a guy like me. And I think one of the things that has happened in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I think it undermines our unity to some degree, and I don't even know if I have an opinion on this, it's just an observation, is that there's a large portion of our fellowship today that don't suffer from alcoholism. They have a drinking problem. And there, it talks about this on page 20 and 21 of the book. It says that there's a type of person, it calls him a hard drinker. And if you look at the description of the hard drinker, he looks like an alcoholic. It says he may be drinking so heavily that it has impaired him physically and mentally. It says he's drinking habitually. He has the habit so badly that it impairs him physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time. It even says, but if a sufficient reason, ill health, falling in love, warning from a doctor, becomes operative, that this guy has an ability, with the help maybe of a doctor, it says he might even need detox if he's been hitting it heavy, has an ability to stop or moderate on his own. He doesn't, when he stops drinking and he's been detoxed, he doesn't suffer from alcoholism. Now, AA, for him, because of our popularity, has become a wonderful support group, like it, to fill the social void in their life that was left when they stopped going to the bars. It's kind of like AA's the sober Elks for those people, right? The problem with that is in 1976, I'm in a halfway house and I'm dying of alcoholism. And the first time I ever reached out to a sponsor, I grabbed a guy that basically he had a three-step program of recovery. Step one, don't drink. Step two, go to at least at one meeting a week. And step three, sell Amway. And the sad part about it is, in this experience, is that that program of recovery was adequate and sufficient for him. He was a very happy man. He was very successful. But he's not enough. Looking back, I am convinced that he didn't have alcoholism that I have alcoholism. And I'm trying to use him as a sponsor and emulate his program of recovery. But his program of recovery, he has the Nancy Reagan thing. Just say no. It works for him. But I'm the guy that no matter how much I say no, I can say no, 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 no. Okay. You see, for an alcoholic of my type, there's a yes in every barrel of no's. I mean, it's in there. It may be at the top, it may be at the bottom, but it's in there and it's coming at me. With untreated alcoholism, it's coming to the surface. And that's why I kept drinking again. And I know what it's like to drink when I have absolutely made up my mind I'll never touch that stuff again. When I'm on paper, I take a drink. I'm going to go to prison for 2 years. I'm not going to drink, and I mean this. And no matter how tremendous my resolve is, the emotions that are incurred from having this spiritual illness of alcoholism untreated will gradually grind away my resolve. And one day, I got a screw it switch in my head. And one day, it's just worked on me, and it's just, screw it. And all of a sudden, the insanity returns, and I don't fit here. I have no connection with God. I have no connection with you. And I have no connection with myself. I have lost me. I don't even know who I am. I've been trying to be so many things to so many people. And I am separate from myself. I have no integrity. I don't know. I don't have principles in my life like do what you say you're going to do when you say you're going to do it. I say one thing and do something else. I'm one thing to you and another thing to you. I don't know who I am. I am disconnected and separate from myself. I don't even know who I am. I'm disconnected and separate from God or any sense of power. And I'm disconnected and separate from you. I know what it's like to sit in AA and feel the loneliness. To feel the loneliness. On my last drunk, I tried to take my own life, and I stood on a bridge with a bottle of Richard's Wild Irish Rose trying to get up enough courage to jump. And if you'd have asked me why I was there, why I was going to kill myself, I wouldn't have told you alcoholism. If I could have been honest with you, I might have told you I was dying of loneliness. But it wouldn't have... The alcohol didn't occur to me as the problem. The alcohol really was a solution that no longer worked, and I couldn't understand why. All I wanted was to recapture the sense of unity in a part of that I had once obtained in taking a few drinks. I think as an alcoholic, I'm cut out of a different piece of cloth than normal people. I think that there are people in this world that unmedicated and undrunk can be by themselves or with people, and they're really okay either way. And I have always hungered for unity. I've always wanted to be a part of. I've always wanted that connection. And I'll tell you something, in AA, once you've tasted the connection with God, and you've tasted the connection with other people, and you've found your center and who you are, when resentments come along and things that block me off, the desolation now is always much more pronounced. I can't... The bad side of AA is that once you get it here, the loss when you lose it is awful. It is awful. And I know, that's why I still come to meetings and work these steps, and I call guys like these when I'm in my head and I'm separate. And I'm locked up in here. I'm locked up. I'm disconnected. No unity at all. I was in a treatment center one time, and this therapist said, this well-meaning psychologist said to me, "Bob, the problem is you're not in touch with your feelings." Well, I understand what she was talking about. I couldn't identify my feelings, but if I was any more in touch with them, I would have slit my throat. The problem is that my feelings and my life are on me like that creature in Alien that attaches itself to your face. And I can't get it off. And I eventually drink because I got to get free of me. I got to get free of me. And when alcohol works and I take 5 shots of Jack Daniels, you hear this, as it just falls off. And all of a sudden, oh, here I am. Here I am. I can play now. This is good. I hunger for freedom. I hunger for unity. I can't stand the loneliness. I've never been able to. And I was ashamed of myself for being that way. It is one of my greatest treasures. It is the thing that forces me to clear up the separation between me and you. The thing that forces me to clear up the separation between me and God. And also to be on the same page with myself, so I am but one person rather than a whole bunch of people. No wonder I had so many, you know, they talk about the committee. I had a committee in my head. I was so many things to so many people so often I didn't know who I was. When I'm not in the middle of a lot of fear or resentment, which happens from time to time, I have a sense of oneness. I'm okay. There's on the newer people as they come in, that I could be concerned with you enough that this will fall off of me in my concern and attention of you. Really, when Alcoholics Anonymous works at its best, is when it relieves me of the bondage of self, as alcohol did. And alcohol did that tremendously. I could walk into a bar with me on me so heavy that I'm so alone, painfully alone, and 5 shots of whiskey, and I was relieved of the bondage of self. 7 shots of whiskey, and I could look around the bar and love everybody. My people. Now that's unity. That's unity. Now maybe it's a chemically induced unity, but for a guy who's never had it, it's the closest I ever got. It's the closest I ever got. And I found that in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I found it through what Keith and Clint are going to talk about, through the principles of AA, the things in the steps that are designed to reduce the separation so I can be connected. And ultimately to carry the message and care about somebody and think about somebody other than me. God seems to work the most effectively in my life when I'm not paying much attention to it. And the only way a guy who is basically self-obsessed and self-involved by nature, it is my propensity, is to be involved with you. And if I'm involved with you, I'm not as involved with me. And that's when God seems to work very well in my life. Very well. I want to read something. And then we're going to go do some questions. And this is from the 12th tradition in the long form. "And finally, we of Alcoholics Anonymous believe that the principle of anonymity has an immense spiritual significance. In Alcoholics Anonymous, if I am connected with you, and I'm not better than, I'm not less than, we're all on the same team, then I am anonymous here. I am not a personality here. I am one of you. It reminds us that we are to place principles before personalities, that we are actually to practice a genuine humility. This to the end that our great blessings may never spoil us, that we shall forever live in thankful contemplation of Him who presides over us all. I believe what Einstein said. In my best moments, I know, as I look around with the guys I sponsor and the people I've come to love in Alcoholics Anonymous, I know that it is only an illusion that there is more than one of us here. And if you've ever been touched by that sense of connectedness to people, and I think it happens that it's best when you're listening to a guy that you love and you're connected to him, one of the guys you sponsor. If you've ever known that, I don't think anything else will ever do again. Why don't we have 5 to 7 to 10 minutes of questions, if there's any questions. And if after that, we'll take a 5-minute break and we'll come back and we'll do segment number 2. Are there any questions?
When you're in a meeting and they're talking outside issues like meds, do you share what your feelings are?
There have been times where I felt good about how I did that, and there have been times when I did it and I didn't feel good about it. And I don't believe that the traditions were ever designed to step on people's toes. They're designed as a vehicle to actually facilitate more unity and love in AA. And I see, if I do it with a resentment, if I sit there during the meeting, and now by the end of the meeting I'll finally share it, now I'm pissed, what I say at that point is not useful. And the problem is not in what's going on in the meeting. The problem at that point is what's in me. But I say something, and I try to say it in a loving manner. One of the best lines, I think, in working with others, when it talks about other alcoholics, it says that we should try to put ourselves in their place and see how we would like to be approached if the tables were turned. And if I'm not blocked up with resentment, I'll tell you, I can do that real well. I can put myself in their position and get a sense of how somebody could say it to me if I was in their shoes, and I wouldn't be put off. But if I'm in a place of resentment, then I take an adversarial position towards that person, and it's not productive. It just, I think I'm right, they think they're right. And I tell you, you know something about me? When I'm really, really right, I'm wrong. I'm telling you, when I'm really right, I'm wrong. And that is almost a spiritual axiom for me. Anybody else?
Bob, you mentioned something earlier that you can look at someone, you can be in your ear, six, but you mentioned it's not you, it's them. Is that a nice part when they talk about the disease is so cunning that if our disease tells us that we don't have a disease? Was that what you said?
You lost me. I don't remember saying that it was not me, it was them. I think I did it the other way around.
Yeah, but eventually it was you who was sick.
Right, I am the seat of the judgment. I am the seat of the separation. I'm the guy that's got to change.
Right.
I can't reduce the separation between me and you by changing you. I can do it by changing me and my position to you. Bill Wilson said something very important. He said that honesty gets us here, but it is tolerance that keeps us here. I didn't know what tolerance was. I thought tolerance was being politely pissed off at someone. That's not tolerance at all. Tolerance is really what happens in the steps. Tolerance in mechanics, when they talk about tolerance, sometimes the tolerances in an engine will get off. And what happens is the moving parts rub each other without any tolerance, and they create friction that eventually will blow the engine up. And what a mechanic has to do is come in there and shave down the parts or do something to change the tolerances to allow the moving parts to move freely of each other without creating so much friction that they destroy each other. And that's what I have to do. I have to develop tolerance. I have to change my view of you to allow you to be exactly the way you are, and I'm okay with it, and I'm really all right. And I'm really, not pretend, not podium talk, because you can have podium talk and go home and have an ulcer. But I mean, really change me so that you're okay. That's where the freedom comes. There was a hand over here.
Yeah, my name's Randy.
Hi, Randy.
The question I had is, like, you talked about how, like, other programs, 12 steps, have arisen, like, in teaching centers and hospitals and groups, and how they're kind of, like, riding on our shoulders. You know what I mean? They're kind of, like, going, oh, hey, we're going to make it better. Or, I mean, as I'm seeing it like we have AA. And I'm dealing with this in my own family. A family member that went to a hospital, and all of a sudden she's seeing a counselor, a therapist, this and this. They're putting her on pills to get her off the alcohol. And then the next thing I know is they go, well, we'll go to this program so you can get more therapy. But yet you're mentioning, like, alcohol, you know what I mean, like they're riding on a 12-step program, but they're not actually having the people do the steps. Is that going to be detrimental to our organization in the long run? As a whole?
I got to clean something up here. The tradition that I break within myself the most, and I struggle with the most, and I have the worst time with, and I'm the most deficient in, is that we have no opinion on outside issues, right? And I am very deficient, and I, as you're sharing, I'm sitting here realizing, boy, did I probably broke that tradition in myself a half dozen times in my talk, because I'm opinionated, but I like to think I'm just making accurate observations here. But I am very opinionated about the stuff you're talking about. I'm very opinionated. And what I have to trust in is the power here. And if I clean up my side of the street and I stick my hand out and offer the message of Alcoholics Anonymous to these new guys, and I try to maintain some integrity in my group with the traditions, that I can't affect Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. I can't make it right. I can't make it better. But maybe with the guys I sponsor, I can create a little thing here, you know? And then maybe some of them will pass some of that on to some guys. And maybe if I'm real lucky, when my daughter, if she ends up to be an alcoholic and she comes to Alcoholics Anonymous, she'll get the real McCoy here. She'll get the real deal. Go ahead.
I have a question on tradition three, the desire to stop drinking. What about the strange alcoholic and the unity within the group? And the fact of the pure alcoholic. I hear a lot of that as a sponsor and in AA meetings about the pure alcoholic and how there's so hard to be between now. And we hear the term strange alcoholic. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Without being opinionated, I don't know. I'll tell you that I was in general service back. I was in general service back in from 1979. Through the period where we were, the big issue back then was problems other than alcohol, right? And I believe that there are drug addicts that are alcoholics, and I believe there are drug addicts that aren't. And I think as a sponsor, for me to work with a guy, it's my job to ascertain. In the big book, it talks about interviewing people. And it says, if you're convinced he's an alcoholic, then you do, et cetera, et cetera. And I try to talk to guys about the phenomenon of craving and what Dr. Silkworth talks about. We live in an era where if you're an alcoholic and then you're on the street and all you've ever done today is just drink and you've never tried any other drugs, you're kind of a rarity almost. Now, some of those people, I'll give you a good example. We're going to have to cut pretty soon. I made an amends at 17 and a half years sober to a gal in Pennsylvania that I couldn't find in my first 4 years. And we become real friendly, and she calls me every once in a while. She's a good gal. and her, it's a long story, but the thing is, from 1969, 70, and part of 71, my alcoholism took a left turn, and I was a heroin addict. Now, during that period of time, I had such a monkey on my back, if I took two drinks of alcohol, I wasn't instantly compelled to go get more alcohol. I would if I couldn't get any heroin. But it was like the phenomenon of craving took a left turn. Now, does that mean that the phenomenon of craving prior to that always drove me to alcohol, and after that drove me to alcohol? Does that mean I wasn't an alcoholic for those 2 years? I think it makes a left turn, sometimes in some of us. Now, this is an opinion. Now, I don't know this to be true. My sponsor kind of feels, he's a little different about this, has a little different view of it. I try to find out, guys, what happens to them when they drink. What happens to you when you take two drinks? Does it cause something inside you, a hunger that you have to set, that you have to satisfy? Have you ever taken just two drinks and said to yourself, oh, this is just right, I don't really need any more, I'm just fine here? Or can you take the test? The test it talks about in chapter 3. It says, go over to a bar, try some controlled drinking, try to drink and stop abruptly. Ever been able to take that test? It's bad. It's a hard test to take. Somewhere through this, halfway through the second drink, you become aware that this is not a good test day. It's a good test, but it's not a good test day, because there's a blonde down there that wants to have a drink with me, and then Joe's here, and I, you know, it's not a good test day. Do I have that? Do I have the phenomenon of craving? And do I have the other part? On the beginning of Way Agnostics, it has two things it talks about that makes, if they exist in you, you're probably alcoholic. It says, one, if you find when you honestly want to, you cannot quit entirely. What do they mean by entirely? Or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take. If those two things are in place, it says you're probably alcoholic. And if that be the case, you're beyond human aid. You need a power greater than yourself, or you're screwed. And I try to sit down with guys and find out. I turned a guy down. I not too long ago, because I talked to him and he had a problem. His problem was cocaine. And the reason I turned him down is not because he used cocaine. The reason I turned him down is he said that he could walk away, he could have two drinks, three drinks, and go home and watch TV and never have to do nothing else. And when he said that, I said, I'm glad you're here. Here's some open meetings you can go to, and I hope you get something out of coming to AA. But I don't know that I can work with you, because I don't know that we're on the same page here. I love you, and if I can, you can talk to me, and if I can help you. But I don't know that I can really connect with you here with the steps. And I think some people in AA want to help everybody. But if I help him, then maybe a guy that's dying of alcoholism won't get helped. And I got to be here for the guys that suffer like I suffer. All right, one more, and then we'll have to go ahead.
What does it mean that there should be no professional classes
there? Let me read the long form of the eighth tradition. Most people never heard this. It says, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional. We define professionalism as the occupation of counseling alcoholics for fees or hire. But we may employ alcoholics where they are going to perform those services for which we might otherwise have to engage non-alcoholics. Good example of that is the custodian of central office, the guy that cleans up, the secretary, the data clerk that inputs stuff for the meeting lists. Such special services may be well recompensed, but our usual AA 12-step work is never to be paid for. Outside issue. Oddly, the book says that my 12-step work should never be paid for. I think one of the reasons that if all the professions that a sober alcoholic can get into, they say, and I don't know how to prove this, but I've heard this said many times statistically, that the highest relapse rate is alcoholism counselor. that you might have a better job being a drug dealer and staying sober than you would. And the reason is a trap there. You put a guy, and I did, I was a counselor in early sobriety. You put me in a position where people are coming to me for the answers. Well, I must have them or else they wouldn't ask. So I don't need a sponsor anymore. And I work 10 hours a day helping drunks for a living. I don't want to go out and pick up a guy and go on a 12-step call. Now I've just cut my own throat.
The real alcoholic and the problem drinker. And I know some of the meetings, you get a lot of these people that come in, and it's a social gathering for them. You know, and they can come in and basically... You know, I know what the page 159 talks about. We have our social gatherings and then one week we have a meeting. And what happens is it all gets smooshed together and they come in and there's party time while they're there trying to get a meeting going and whatnot. How do you, you know, if you have these people that come in there that want to control what's going on in the meetings, if they say, well, I've got 23 years or 31 years or whatever in the meeting, and they're not even a true alcoholic or real alcoholic, you know, you don't even know if they're a problem drinker. How do you deal with
trying
to people like that?
Tolerance. I think it's a good... I think after this meeting, we should organize the AA stormtroopers. And... We'll just send them... You know, after... They'll come out in the parking lot after a meeting of being out of line. A couple guys will just say, come with us. We got to take a break. Bye.